Okay. Thank you so much, Stephen and Julianne and the AARE executive. It's really a pleasure to be here this morning. I'm really impressed with the way that AARE has been supporting the work of doctoral students and early career researchers, because obviously they are the future, but also they're often the sources of some of the most interesting and challenging ideas and debates. And for that reason, I'm always really delighted to be able to work with you. I'm going to talk today about a couple of things that, in my mind, have sort of connect, and I'm hoping I can make the bridges between them, even though they appear a little discrete, arguably. I'm going to play a bit with the Julianne's comments on that sort of more philosophical bent of what is good educational research and how do we know when we see it, and to try and think about what makes a good educational researcher in the current climate and what are some of the dangers and the richnesses that that affords. I also want to make a bit of an apology. This is the first time I've used the University of Melbourne template, so I'm feeling very self-conscious about it, but it was kind of being a good ambassador for my School of Education, so here we go. So I'm going to start off by giving some snapshots from my own research, which has been investigating these broader problems or bigger questions about what are the social norms for educational actors. I'm going to talk about three projects where that was a kind of underpinning question. And then going to move from there to this category, the invention, if you like, the invention of the category of the early career researcher. Then to think about what ethical conduct means in that practice of being an early career researcher. Touch on what I see as the emergence of a new politics of recognition and misrecognition. Embrace or note, if I have time, a debate or an argument put forward by the philosopher of education, Gert Biester, on five challenges for the philosophy of education for the public good, and use those as a way, as a sort of springboard, into thinking about what might be comparable or parallel challenges or virtues for the early career researcher. So I hope you can bear with me as I try and go through all that. So one way that I've been trying to think about this topic is through these questions of subjectivity, or if you like, identity, normativity, or the ideals. What are the norms, the ideals of identity, and dividing practices? How do certain norms set up, you know, the norm? A norm sets up the non-norm, right? So what are the sort of dividing practices in education? I'm going to talk very briefly only about two and then elaborate a little bit more on one on the history of adolescence. And through this, I want to remind us or bring to the fore the issue that educational research and the work of doing education as a teacher, as an educator, as a policy person, but particularly thinking about education research, is a knowledge-building practice and a person-forming practice. And I think we need to keep those two dimensions of being a researcher in play. So across the range of my work, I've wanted to understand these historically shifting norms and aspirations for being a good student or a good teacher, and their attendant, their associated elisions, erasures, inversions, exclusions, and so forth. Now, these normativities reveal much, but not everything, about dominant and contested values, ethics, forms of knowledge, purposes, and ideal and repressed subjectivities. From the longitudinal study that I conducted with Lynn Yates, Making Modern Lives, which came out as Making Modern Lives, it was following young people from the end of primary school to the end of secondary schooling and the year beyond. And that was concerned with a number of things to do with the interaction between school cultures and biography, between new forms of social inequality that were arising and young people sort of daydreaming and aspirations for themselves and for their futures. Underpinning all that was an interest in what were the new norms of being a young person then and how did they vary across school sites and cross school cultures. and in some of that work we took on some of the language of Bourdieu, but not entirely, and looked at the ways in which we could see that as forms of disposition that relative, that persisted or changed across time. In earlier work, in work before that, in fact in my PhD, it was a very Foucauldian study of feminism and education, and I was interested there in the new norms that feminism was establishing for being an ethical subject, both as a teacher and as a student. And ethical there became forms of embodying and pedagogies to foster non-sexist, non-traditional subjects. And that was informed, as I said, by Foucauldian concepts of technologies of the self and thinking of feminism and other progressive movements as governmental projects, not just emancipatory projects. The one I want to focus in a little bit more detail is the current ARC that I've been working on with my colleague Katie Wright. It's on the history of adolescence and education for citizenship across from the 1930s to the 1970s. Now that's a kind of, as the title suggests, a ridiculously ambitious project. There's a lot going on in those 50 years. But we've divided it into three decades, the 30s, 50s and 70s, and undertaking oral histories and archival research in each of those times, and doing oral histories with former teachers and students in each of the decades. But what I want to talk about today is some work I was undertaking looking at norms of citizenship in the 1930s and the differences, the differentiation between the norm of being a good citizen, a good cosmopolitan citizen for white Australians, and well, they weren't named as white, for Australian adolescents, and then the implied and the obverse of possibilities for subjectivity and educability of Indigenous students during that period. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about that. So I've got text, so I'm about to get into sort of, you know, serious mode here. So I've been researching the aims and nature of citizenship education and the practical and pedagogical techniques for learning how to be a citizen in the interwar years in Australia. In 1930s Australia, these discussions bore the influence of ideas from progressive education, exemplified in child-centred and active learning approaches to curriculum, often accompanied by reference to the potential of education to achieve transformative social change. So on the one hand, there's this great thing that, you know, we could... it's a long story in education about being able to produce this type of change. But I was also interested in understanding what Tom Popkiewicz has called the dividing practices of this type of inclusive emancipatory citizenship education, and the way in which these aspirations for the desired student citizen constructed a non-citizen, the problematic student excluded from recognition as a future citizen. So citizenship in this analysis is not just a legal status, but involves practices and discourses that turn some subjects into citizens and some into strangers, understood as an ensemble of acts that create both citizens and their others. This turns from a focus on rights or denial of rights to a more familiar approach in citizenship studies to an analysis of a diverse array of acts of citizenship and modes of recognition of the citizen that vary across time and place, and cannot be understood as simply about a narrative of progress towards greater and greater inclusion and tolerance. My interest has been in the way progressive education, despite its inclusive and tolerant face, also and inevitably marginalised some students. In this case, in the 1930s, the axis of inclusion and exclusion was related to a sense of place. The world-minded student, the Australian student, could be contrasted to the nation-minded student, but in the background there was also the Indigenous student, implicitly or explicitly understood within these progressive discourses as localised in a more limiting sense. Now, I developed this argument by looking at two major international conferences that were held in the late 30s. One was the Fellowship of Education, which was organised by the New Education Fellowship, a progressive educational association. And they had maybe AARE could aspire to this. It was a travelling conference that went for 5 weeks. and imagine. And we think 5 days is enough. But they visited every state from about August 1937 and 6 weeks on. And it was a collection of international experts and locals talking about the state of education and commenting on and providing expert advice on the state of education in Australia. There was a range of presenters and contributors. On the whole, though, they came from the more progressive end and child-centred end of education thinking at that time. And there was a lot of discussion in this interwar period about how we might build an education system that would foster, as Alice Hoyer, a Victorian educator, talked about, world-mindedness among young people. How could we develop young people in education in a way that was cosmopolitan, outward-looking, and looked, you know, fraternal, brotherly love, and working for peace and understanding. And this is a very key. So citizenship education in this period had some very pressing agendas. Roughly the same time, in fact the year before, in 1936, there was a conference held in Hawaii called the Education of the Native in the Pacific. And it too was a residential, well this one was a residential conference for 5 weeks in Hawaii, convened by Felix Kiesing, an anthropologist from New Zealand, with funding from Yale, University of Yale, and the Carnegie Corporation of New York, which had also funded the Progressive the Fellowship of Education Conference. In this conference, it's as if they were adjacent but on parallel universes. They did not acknowledge or speak to each other, even though they were addressing questions of educability and purpose. Okay, and the future of young people. So I was intrigued by this juxtaposition, and it was an accidental one that I came upon by working in the Carnegie archives and seeing, you know, going through Australia, seeing this and then seeing that. So it's a sort of, to some extent, a little bit of research serendipity. But what I argue, and I'll skip the subtlety of it, what I argue in there is that the educability of Indigenous students is understood as being limited because of their embeddedness in local ties and local communities, and that at puberty the call of the local overtakes any possibility for education beyond that. And that is juxtaposed to the point of adolescence for white Australian, non-Indigenous Australians, as a point of opening up and flourishing. Right. So educability and the good citizen for the non-Indigenous Australian is about openness and cosmopolitan orientation, and the other in this good citizen, this norm of citizenship, is embedded and held back by local and the family. So that's are some of the background questions, that is questions of norms and regulations, dividing practices, that bring me to thinking about the early career researcher arising as a category of concern. Now, in some ways I began thinking about this in a slightly humorous way, right? You know, more playful, you know, so I'm interested in the categories of educational actors, what's happening with researchers. You know, we have mid-career, we have later career, we have early career, the academic labour force is being carved up into all kinds of special needs. And so I began to just sort of free associate a bit about this idea of the early career researcher. And it was very immediate for me too, because at this time I was assistant dean for research training, which is, you know, looking after, managing, signing off on doctoral students and research students, and also encountering a lot of students at that point, at big transition point between completing the PhD and imagining themselves in a different space, imagining themselves as a researcher, and the space that they can occupy is the early career researcher. And obviously, if you're a Foucauldian of even the slightest kind, that rings bells. And I have to say, I have the pleasure of working with many fine, fabulous doctoral students and postdocs who hear me talk out these things sometimes. So, What do we know of this category, this invention of the new category? What norms, effects, practices and misrecognitions does it give rise to? On the one hand, there are many examples of positive and supportive practices, targeted fellowships, and I've been a beneficiary of them, and others in the room most likely too. Competitive funding bodies have special schemes. Faculties and departments proclaim, pretend or actually do provide additional support for early career researchers. University research officers tend to your needs or their needs. Senior staff have performance review processes linked to their record in mentoring this particular category, who often carry a substantial amount of the teaching and chalk face work of university departments. In my own workplace, the School of Education at Melbourne, we have an extremely effective early career academic committee that provides mutual support for their colleagues, their peers, organises workshops and professional development seminars, has garnered representation on the major faculty school committees, and has worked to have early career academics, they wanted to include it to encompass the sort of range of the role, not just the research, has sort of infiltrated and has become very much part of the strategic planning and the everyday understanding and discourse in the school about what we need to take account of when we're thinking about the future and research plans. Now, this is a really exceptional group of people and a very impressive activity. They won an award recently from the Association of Tertiary Education Managers for their excellence in research management. So, you know, bouquets to them. On the other hand, we also could say, and I'm sure many of you have stories to confirm this, that absolutely not enough is being done, that there remain many gaps, unacknowledged concerns, inadequate recognition of both the practical material issues as well as the emotional concerns of insecurity, of fears of not being good enough, of not knowing how to play the game, or being on top of, or how to ever get on top of the seemingly endless pressure to say yes, to take on more work. It doesn't go away. Now, at the same time, it seems to me that there are a number of other possibly unintended and even contradictory consequences that flow from this category. It can also be seen or work to produce a group of the academic population identified as needy, as in need of support, of mentoring, of being apprenticed through a rough and tumble environment, and of being vulnerable to falling off the career and personal pathway. In this way, a whole repertoire of incentives has been created to ensure that this category of academic is identifiable, managed, surveilled, and supported. And so you don't probably can hear, you could take a governmental analysis of this, a Foucauldian governmental analysis. Inevitably, the university, the academic environment, is constructed as inhospitable, dominated by a get-ahead ethos. And in order to survive this rough terrain, we need to develop a range of strategic and personally protective responses to survive. Now, I also think for many people working in education and in other fields, professional fields, some of these supports and forms of governance can be experienced or seen as quite infantilizing, of turning one into a dependent being, a feeling exacerbated for some who've been accustomed in many cases to working in positions of responsibility, accustomed to feeling competent, to being recognised as competent and as not immediately in need of restorative or compensatory interventions. Now, of course, it is tricky business to navigate the academic world. It is full of arcane and slightly bizarre rituals, where gatekeeping is not only second nature, but is in fact a highly prized and rewarded activity. The tougher you are, the better you are. Keeping people out, down and desperate, helping them to, you know, beg to do more and to be rewarded for taking on all that extra work. However, having said that, I want to open up in that sort of context what new norms of academic life are in train, what understandings about intellectual and personal life are being reworked, and in particular and in contextual ways. Are there specific questions about being an early career researcher within the field of education, in comparison to being in biomedicine or in humanities? No matter that it is a broad field and that many of us have little speeches saying that we're not really in education anyway. Okay. Sorry, I just always do this. 5, 6. Okay. Now, I am going to start speaking really quickly, so, and I'm mindful of the time. I'm going to relate just a small scenario, and I see Rob's here. Some weeks ago, on a beautiful Saturday afternoon when there was a big horse race going on in Melbourne, I forgot which one it was, but thanks, Cox Plate, yeah, Rob was over. A group of academics, myself, Jane Kenway, Mari Brennan, Liz Zippin, and Rob and I, sitting around, as you do on a Saturday afternoon, reading a book and talking about it. Anyway, just so happened that the book was by Kay Gibson Graham on Take Back the Economy. And the question that we were ruminating was how might we take back the university? You know, what kinds of strategies, or not even strategies, but how do we respond as any type of academic to the current environment? And it was a very interesting discussion and, you know, as often these things are, took me in areas I hadn't anticipated. By the end of that night, I was sort of mulling away in bed and thinking about this and dwelling on these issues around ethical conduct and relational justice, and trying to think about, expand the normal conversation about early career research away from strategy and portfolio building to, I think, a more complicated and contradictory conversation about ethical conduct and recognition and respect. And going back to purposes. The big, you know, unanswerable in a way sometimes, but always having to be asked questions about the purposes of education, but also about the purposes of what you in particular are doing. And I think it is a particularly pronounced question, how to act ethically in the present, when the calls are particularly loud. The call for individualism is particularly loud, even amid the calls for collaboration, because it's a particular kind of collaboration, which I'll talk about in a moment. What does ethical practice look like when we're all trying to get ahead, and how do we do it? So I turned to some work that many people here would, I think, be familiar with, prompted particularly around these issues of recognition to the work, debates between, there's old debates now, between Iris Marion Young and Nancy Fraser on the politics of recognition and distribution. Looking at how one of the, a sort of interlocutor into this debate, policy sociologist Sharon Gewirtz wrote some time ago, following more the line of Iris Marion Young on the politics of difference and politics of recognition. She's interested in questions of relational justice as about the naturing and ordering of social relations, the formal and informal rules which govern how members of societies treat each other on a macro level and at a micro interpersonal level. Thus, it refers to the practices and procedures which govern the organisation of political systems, economic and social institutions, families and one-to-one social relations. So what I'm proposing is that often when we engage with these debates, when I say we, I mean when I've been teaching with these debates and talking with students about them, it's a discussion about out there, in schools. They need to do that. You know, at work, they need to do that. And I'm trying to think about what that means when we bring that lens onto our own practices in the university. And she then asks, drawing together these debates, and Sharon Gewirtz asks, drawing together these debates on social justice, how and to what extent and why do education policies support, interrupt or subvert? And she has a number of 5 points, and it's the blue highlighted one that I'm interested in, which is the promotion of relationships based on recognition, respect, care and mutuality. So these are really just bodies of ideas to think with. A similar theme is raised in the work of John Baker and Kathleen Lynch on effective equality, where they offer an expanded understanding of equality, not simply linked to redistribution, not simply material resources, or even to recognition in the way in which it's been played out in sort of cultural politics of recognition. They draw attention to inequalities arising from inequalities of love, care, and solidarity. And I think I just wanted to carry this one forward for a little bit more. I'm going to take three more minutes. Is that all right? Now, with those sorts of debates at the back, I was reading a paper by Gert Biester, philosopher of education. Philosophy of Education for the Public Good, Five Challenges and an Agenda. Now, I'm not a philosopher, let alone a philosopher of education, but I am interested in philosophical questions and in particular how regular people encounter, identify and navigate philosophical concerns in their everyday and working life. For example, how teachers have understood the purposes of education, how students work out what is fair and reasonable behaviour, how we might treat others justly, and how schools and the project of education are both part of knowledge building and people making activities. Gert Biester's very pithy essay on philosophy of education for the public good maps out five challenges for researchers and practitioners in education. I'm just going to signal those briefly here today as a point, a sort of bridge to talk about how we might think about that in relation to early career research. I really urge you to read this paper. I think it's an easy read. It's very accessible. Educational Philosophy and Theory, Volume 44, No. 2012. He differentiates between education, not learning, arguing that elsewhere he's talked about the learnification, that we talk too much about learning, whereas if we turn to education, it takes us to the question of purposes. So I'm just really telescoping the essence of what he says, and it warrants further reading. So again, from abstract decontextualized learning, where the outcome matters, to the purpose, why learn and what are we learning and with what purpose in mind. Weakness, not strength. He observes that there's a sort of strong language emerging in educational discourse where we have impacts and influences, and we know that this cause-effect relations are kind of, if I come in with an intervention, I'm going to produce this. He wants to attend more to the open, not so much the open-ended, but the sort of weakness, the relational, the interaction, the hermeneutic and interpretive aspect of education, not only the strong part of it, and he calls that weak forms. Existence, not essence. Now, this is obviously an older philosophical dilemma. His take on it is to look at the way in which we are all unique, not simply that we're all multiply different from each other, but to think about uniqueness in terms of irreplaceability. And that's, again, a relational question. Who am I in relation to others? And it takes us back into thinking of education in terms of subjectivity and interiority. Soul, not brain, similar movement, where brain discourse, as we know, is fairly dominant at the moment. And he is calling for to not soul in the sort of theological sense, in the soul, but to think of something more than, and that we need another language in education that can capture this more than, which is not just the brain. Truth, not perspectives. He takes issue with the standard take on postmodernism as about proliferation of perspectives and that there's no truth. And he says actually postmodernism calls for a stronger engagement with the question of truth. It's an epistemological challenge for us to think about truth claims and the means we need to take truth more seriously, which is not to say that there's a totalizing answer, there's not a thing called the truth, but we need to engage with truth more seriously. So I am playing with this a little bit, I'm trying to think a bit more seriously anyway, about these challenges and trying to think about what they mean in relation to the work we've been talking about here and your everyday practices and mine too, to an extent. So these are a few overstated challenges, gesturing towards possibly some virtues, and ethical practices in terms of the public and the personal good. Purposes, not outcomes. Some of them are pretty self-evident, but I'll just go through them. That we need to think about, you know, what we're doing and why. What are our particular purposes, and what do we see as the purposes of our discipline and of the area in which we're working. Not only be driven by, I've got to get that done, I've got to get that, I've got to get that. You know, so go back slower. Respect, not rivalry. How do we embed relationality in a culture where competitiveness and rivalry is becoming core to the way in which we conduct our everyday work? How do we rebuild collegiality? And it may take, I'm trying not to be nostalgic for a time that probably never existed, but I think there are challenges about how we, what collegiality means, not only in this competitive ethos, but when we're all pretty time poor as well. And where, community, not competition. Again, as a sort of a continuation of that theme. And in that, I want to touch on this notion of collaboration, because that is obviously another big imperative. It's a bit of a buzzword. You need to be collaborating. You need to be building up in a team. Scale up. Multiple outputs. You know, big impact. Right? None of this solo stuff going on. Thanks very much. However, there are different forms of collaboration, and I think we need to remain alert to what Jenny Lewis, in a study of this, has called big C and little C collaboration. Big C collaboration is that, you know, the lab model, the biological and physical sciences, where you aggregate, you come together, and you work. Right? It's and there's a conflation between that model of collaboration and academic collaboration. She calls that instrumental collaboration, big C. Little C collaboration is more fluid and porous, and includes things such as working with one or two people, reading groups, seminars, peer review work, the service to the profession, right? Interpersonal collaboration, which may lead to big C collaboration or may not, but has to be regarded, she argues, has to be regarded as having integrity in its own right, and that this has obvious implications for how we develop policies and the rewards that accrue from those sorts of policy agendas. One interesting finding from her work, she did this sort of social network analysis of, after sort of surveying people in social sciences, humanities and the physical sciences, what they understood about collaboration and how they thought it manifest, is that for people in the humanities and social sciences, the only area in which their overt, measurable forms of collaboration exceeded those of the sciences was in service to their profession. Right? Extensive peer reviewing, extensive work on editorial boards, extensive outward-oriented work, which is typically not counted in or recognised as a form of meaningful collaboration. Curiosity, not strategy. It's a hard one. Return to those big ideas and the questions which are motivating you, and sort of be enlivened by that rather than those sort of outcomes questions about where you want to be and how you want to get on. And I'm not saying that strategy is unimportant. It's a question of balance and reminding why you're being strategic. In and of itself, it's not really the thing. And finally, openness. Not imbalance. So openness to being a good student, an academic and a researcher, and also to having a good life. And thinking about the knowledge making and the person making aspects of being an early career researcher. And I'll finish there. Thanks.